drawing the connections between a sick society, a sick planet, and our own sick bodies.
As a physician, you know, I've always felt like you can see the wounds of capitalism on the bodies of unhoused people. You can see what's happening to the body through looking at the chronic venous stasis in the legs and the presence of edema because they're not allowed to sit and lie down in public. So constantly forced to stand up and walk. You know, you can see the marks of society's social pathology make their way onto the body. And so what we really understood in this book and what we offer in this book is a way of diagnosing illness that extends outside of our bodies into the spaces around the body, into the lines of power that have been drawn through histories and how these things are shaping how our bodies are responding. And the bodies are responding quite in a normal and healthy way to a extremely unhealthy, abnormal world around us that has been altered through colonialism and capitalism. So that is, you know, what we are sharing with the world in this book is an opportunity to see how these connections are literally drawn in the body of the earth, and in our social body.
That's doctor and activist Rupa Marya. We talk with her and with her co-author, writer, and food activist Raj Patel about their book, Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. Then, having the courage to use your voice.
So that's my biggest thing, is having courage. You know what I mean? And that's really what the book is about. The book is to have courage, not to just stand around and watch, but to do something. You know what I mean? And if we could start teaching children that at a young age, that, hey, you're special, you're important. Also have the courage to believe in yourself and the courage to stand up when things aren't going well.
That's country music singer Jimmy Allen. He tells us about his book for children, My Voice is a Trumpet. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If there's anything the COVID-19 pandemic has taught us, it's that social and economic injustice leads to differences in who dies more from a deadly infectious disease. But it's not just COVID. People who are more stressed by poverty and discrimination succumb at higher rates to illness and early death. That's because stress begets inflammation in the body. And inflammation begets all kinds of ills, like cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. But it's not just our bodies. The whole planet is inflamed. In their book, Inflamed, Rupa Marya and Raj Patel draw a link between the body as both metaphor and exemplar of inflammation to climate change and other environmental destruction. They say that inflammation is a biological, social, economic, and ecological pathway. All these pathways, they say, intersect in a manner constructed by the modern world, i.e., by capitalism. Inflamed takes the reader on a medical tour through the different systems of the human body, but unlike a traditional anatomy book, it shows the hidden relationships between our biological systems and the profound injustices of our political and economic systems. Raj Patel is a New York Times best-selling author of The Value of Nothing, Stuffed and Starved, and other books. Rupa Marya is a physician, activist, and co-founder of the Do No Harm Coalition. Well, Raj Patel and Rupa Marya, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
This was just such an amazing book to read, Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. It's a deeply researched and profoundly radical look at the links between the human body, the body of the world, and the body politic. I want to start out just by asking both of you, what brought each of you to write the book? And let's start with Rupa Marya. You're a physician and an activist. What brought you to write this book?
Well, that is the...
At this point in the interview, a hurricane warning alert went off in my phone. It was really loud and everybody noticed. It was for Hurricane Henri, which had been forecast to be a direct hit on my town, but which actually ended up missing us. So when we resumed the interview, Rupa Maria referenced the extreme weather that our messing with the climate is bringing to us ever more often.
That is the reason we were inspired to write this book, is because we are in the midst of a code red for humanity, and it's impacting every area of our lives. This book for me was a chance to put down and investigate and really draw the connections and weave the connections between the things I'd seen at the bedsides of so many patients and in communities where I work, you know, accompanying groups who are struggling for their own health and their dignity. So it was a real wonderful opportunity to sit with Raj and pour our minds together to make these connections that neither of us could have made alone.
And Raj, you are a scholar of the food system. At least that's how I know you. What brought you to write this book with Rupa Maria?
Well, it's odd living under this particular capitalist, colonialist civilization where food and medicine are two different things. In most civilizations, food and medicine are contiguous. They braid through one another. And there are certain foods and medicines that one takes for certain kinds of people, conditions, times of the year. But right now, of course, we live in a moment of human history where food is without seasons, and so is disease. And that is, part of the journey for me was recognizing through Rupa and her work and our collaboration that, you know, a lot of the communities that I've spent time with doing activism around the food system has been, we're engaged in practices not just of growing food, but of health. And understanding how health and medicine and food are connected has been part of the journey for me in recognizing that a lot of the work that I was doing that was ring-fenced as being part of the food system was in fact much deeper than that and much more deeply connected to medicine and to health.
And that makes sense. This book is, you describe it as a political anatomy. Tell us what you mean by that. And I want to say so much of this book is written as metaphor, but metaphor that is so grounded in the totality of reality. So tell us what a political anatomy is.
Yeah, perhaps we could see that as a literal metaphor. Because, you know, when we're talking about how, you know, the Earth's rivers being incarcerated, obstructing the flow of life in that way radically alters the ways in which people get their food and medicine, and then consequently affects their bodies, that all of these systems are interconnected in very deep ways. And so that the systems that were brought into place, the lines of power that have been drawn through colonialism and through capitalism, have altered these ways our bodies have evolved, altered the ecological, social relationships that kept us healthy for thousands of years in specific ecosystems. And so for me as a physician, you know, I've always felt like you can see the wounds of capitalism on the bodies of unhoused people. You can see what it's happening to the body through looking at the, you know, chronic venous stasis in the legs and the presence of edema because they're not allowed to sit and lie down in public. So constantly forced to stand up and walk. The criminalization of their bodies being in public space as they are here in the United States. So I think that, you know, you can see the marks of society's illness, social pathology make their way onto the body. And so what we really understood in this book and what we offer in this book is a way of diagnosing illness that extends outside of our bodies into the spaces around the body, into the lines of power that have been drawn through histories, and how these things are shaping how our bodies are responding. And the bodies are responding quite in a normal and healthy way to a extremely unhealthy, abnormal world around us that has been altered through colonialism and capitalism. So that is, you know, what we are sharing with the world in this book is an opportunity to see how these connections are literally drawn in the body of the earth, and in our social body.
And, you know, the organization of the book is a way of subverting, you know, expectations around what an anatomy looks like. I mean, but people may be familiar with Grey's Anatomy, or, you know, if you've ever watched the TV show House and seen those, you know, the sort of the anatomy of the human body and little sort of pictures of what the layers of different parts of the human body look like, and you know, the geography of the human body. What we're trying to do in this book is subvert that by having chapters that are organized as the different systems within the human body. But then, rather than, for example, in our respiratory chapter, just sort of sticking with the lungs, in fact, we move away from this particular place in the body and instead look at the lines of power that bring, for example, particles from a forest fire thousands of kilometers away into the body and then out again, and the damage that these particles are literally doing to the body. So this is not just a sort of a metaphorical respiration of the earth and, you know, the lungs of the earth are being burned. But in fact, as the lungs of the earth are being burned, your lungs are being burned, not metaphorically, but directly and in tandem and through the same processes. So again, this idea of political anatomy is, in each chapter, we start with the sort of systems that people may be familiar with when they think about their gut microbiome, their digestive system, or their respiratory system, or their circulatory system. But then we go beyond that to look at, you know, we sort of explode the body across the planet and condense the planet into our bodies at the same time. And that's what makes it a political anatomy.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Raj Patel and Rupa Marya about their book, Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. Yes, and you do all this around the central theme of inflammation. I mean, it's right there in your title, Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. So Raj Patel and Rupa Marya, talk about inflammation as both a metaphor and an exemplar. You know, inflammation as a metaphor, let's say, of climate change, but it's also an exemplar, and in precisely the way you just spoke about it, creates inflammation in the body.
Yeah, well, I think for me, when we were thinking about this book, you know, for the last, I guess, 15, almost 20 years working in music and touring with my band, Rupa and the April Fishes, we'd be on the road and working with communities that were struggling for their health and their dignity in ways where you could see the imprint of social disruption and social forces on the well-being of a community. And what I started to notice in this traveling was that groups that had been suffering under colonial rule were impacted most heavily by diseases like cardiovascular disease and diabetes and autoimmune disease. And I started to see this pattern, and I coined the term, you know, with my friends, with my bandmates, and it's almost like this is like a colonial syndrome. And then time went on, and in the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of research has come out that has shown that all of these diseases that we suffer from in modern industrialized societies, or societies whose architecture has been structured through the lines of power dictated by colonialism, all of these societies, these diseases are very prevalent, and they're all, now we understand, are inflammatory diseases. So cardiovascular disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, cancer, depression, anxiety, all these diseases have in their in their makings, a dysregulation, an inflammatory response. And so we started looking at, you know, what is inflammation, and why is this happening? And is this, you know, why are these things happening in the ways that they are? And inflammation, the inflammatory response, is the body's way of healing itself in the face of damage or the threat of damage. We used to think of, you know, the immune system activates in response to foreignness, if it's, you know, self or other, which is going back to these Enlightenment era errors of thought about how our bodies work, that there's a body and a mind, there's a self and an other, there's nature and civilization, there's, you know, human beings and then the environment. But in fact, those dichotomies are really not useful for understanding the sophisticated way in which our bodies are systems within systems, and we as entities, as human beings, are systems within other systems. And all of these things are deeply interconnected. So what we found is that, you know, the latest understanding of the inflammatory response is that it's the body's way of correcting itself in the face of damage, of restoring the optimal working conditions. However, when damage continues unabated, as it does in the face of air pollution, as it does in the face of police violence or racism and environmental toxicities, like right now I'm in Oakland and the air is so bad we can't go outside right now from the wildfires, that these things create the inflammatory response. They set off an inflammatory response in the body. And when that damage keeps coming, the response doesn't shut off. And we're now understanding that that's playing a central role in all of these diseases that I see as a hospital medicine doctor at UCSF. Now, I can give people, you know, the aspirin for their cardiovascular disease and the insulin for their diabetes, but that's not going to make a, you know, that's not going to stem the tide of the rising rates of inflammatory disease all over the world. And that's what we tackle in this book, is advancing a new kind of diagnosis along the lines of a political anatomy that can give us actual effective treatments. Because if you don't know what you're diagnosing, if you don't get at the root of the problem, you will only be offering Band-Aid solutions. So for example, with COVID right now, masking and ventilations in school, that's what we've offered as the solution. And today, Oakland has, you know, 98 It was 50 something earlier this week, now 98 students and staff who are testing positive. So these kinds of system level failures require system level analysis, and inflammation allows us to look at it that way.
Yes. And Raj Patel, talk a little bit about the connection between inflammation and our food system.
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. I mean, picking up what Rupa said, particularly about the threat of damage. It's very interesting how stories are important in conveying or obliterating our understanding about threats of damage. So, for example, we tell ourselves stories about how safe our food system is, and we are reassured by various mechanisms of government that, you know, the way of the future in terms of farming is going to be led by American technology and American know-how, and, you know, industrial agriculture is going to feed the world. Those kinds of stories are dangerous fictions, not just because it is demonstrably the case that this farming system will fry the planet. We now know enough about the way that industrial agriculture works to know that, you know, even if we end fossil fuels, the industrial food system generates enough emissions by itself to kill us all. But the beyond that, that sort of false narrative also hides the actual danger that the food system is causing. So, you know, if you're looking, as we all are, at literatures around pre-existing conditions, you know, comorbidities is a term that now has passed many more people's lips in the past year than it had ever before. And those comorbidities, in large part, can be traced to the US and to the global food system. So, you know, recently there was a report came out saying that Americans spend $1.1 trillion they spent $1.1 trillion in 2019 on food. But the damage caused by that food system was in excess of $2 trillion. So we spend $1 trillion, we cause damage for $2 trillion. Of that damage, fully $1 trillion was the healthcare damage caused by the food that is either being given to us or the damage that the growing of that food causes workers. And those, you know, the idea that our food system is the best of all possible worlds and is going to feed the world is not just a lie, but the mechanisms through which this food system damages us are inflammatory. So whether that's type 2 diabetes or whether it's the various kinds of syndromes and diseases caused by our industrial chemistry that have left our bodies and societies inflamed, in every case, there are clear lines between what is licensed as our storied and happy food system and the actual damage that it causes, and the stories of people who have to fight back against the big lie of the food system.
Yes, and Rupa, tell us a bit also about, you know, in your chapter on digestion, one of the stories you tell about is of a young man who died at the age of 26 of irritable bowel syndrome, I believe it was, or Crohn's disease, from Crohn's disease. I don't know if they're the same thing. And that's an inflammatory bowel disease. Talk about the incredible rise in these kinds of illnesses and how they are connected to this colonial settler capitalism.
Yeah, so it has been interesting to see and astonishing to see the rapid rise of inflammatory bowel disease such as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis since the mid-90s, which is, you know, really when substances like glyphosate hit the global market in a big way. And what we've seen with glyphosate is that it's, you know, changing the microbiome of animals. It's changing the microbiome of the soil. It's changing the microbiome of humans. If it's, you know, our closest relative that we see in the lab is with mice and rats, and it's definitely changing their gut microbiome as well. And it's not just glyphosate, but it's the whole system of how our food is grown and what ends up on our food. And then the amounts of dietary chemicals that are in our foods that are altering our gut microbiome in a way that makes it such that, you know, people who are born and raised and live in the urban United States settings have the least biodiverse guts on planet Earth. And we know that the biodiversity of the gut microbiome confers a resistance to inflammatory bowel disease and actually to all inflammatory diseases. And if we look at, you know, there are some studies that look at different populations, the people with the most biodiverse guts on planet Earth, who also have consequently the lowest rates of inflammatory disease, are indigenous people who are living in culturally intact ways with their surrounding environments. And what we've seen, you know, with Crohn's disease that, you know, especially in the pediatric population, there's been some really interesting data around fecal transplant. So if you've got, you know, a young person with Crohn's disease and you can give them a healthy, robust, diverse microbiome in the gut, replace their, you know, denuded microbiome with a healthy, robust one, you can move Crohn's disease into remission. And so there have been some very powerful and interesting studies around that. There's also some association with young children getting antibiotics at a young age, several rounds, having an increased risk of Crohn's disease. So we are seeing an important role of the microbiome, of the gut microbiome in these kinds of diseases. And we have to think of all the ways in which the gut microbiome is being impacted. And what we're learning is that so many things impact it, from our food system, as I just discussed, the dietary chemicals, processed foods, and then also things like stress. So we have a whole chapter on stress and debt, and the connection between the brain and the gut and the microbiome is a very important one for human immune functioning and development. And so, you know, what we're seeing right now is that the capitalist response to that is, let's go find some indigenous people with great microbiomes and, you know, gather their poop and replicate it in a lab and sell it in this rewilding of the gut. We saw the headline in the New York Times from an ethical scientist here. But this is exactly the, you know, the theft of indigenous people that has been a part of colonial plunder for the last 600 years. And the error in thought there is that you could simply just take a pill and replace and re-inoculate what is actually a living representative of a whole host of relationships. And so the reason our indigenous relatives in the Amazon have a robust gut microbiome is because they're in relationship with their surrounding ecology, with the web of life. And those relationships don't exist in modern capitalist cultures. And so that is really what we get at in the book, is that this isn't simply, you know, a couple policy tweaks and changes that need to happen to improve our health. This is abandoning the colonial capitalist cosmology and re-entering our relationships with the web of life in order to have the possibility of health. And that means in order for that to happen, a lot of things need to change. Because as we're seeing with right now, the struggle with Line 3, with Dakota Access Pipeline, we have all the data we need to know that our planet is on fire and that life on planet Earth for human beings is getting very uncomfortable. And there's very little action. There's very little substantive action around that. So aside from what our Indigenous friends are doing on the front line. So it's a really critical time to look at the mistakes, the errors of thought that have brought us here into systems that do not support our health on a wide scale.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Raj Patel and Rupa Marya about their book, Inflamed: Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. And would you like to weigh in on that also, Raj?
No, I mean, I think Rupa said it rather perfectly. I think, you know, the idea that there is a pill for us or, you know, a magic single policy of one kind or another is precisely the error here, that we can individually get our way out of the situation is to compound the problem that got us here. And in fact, you know, it's been very interesting having conversations about this book in sort of lifestyle progressive communities where folk are making decisions, say, around vaccination that are very much about protecting their bodies and viewing their bodies as temples, as opposed to perhaps understanding that those bodies nonetheless circulate in communities where people like Rupa find themselves on the front line. And insofar as people are not getting vaccinated and then have to come to Rupa when they're in dire distress, they're posing a threat not just to Rupa, but to her family, her community. And I think it's very interesting to see how the culture of individualism has reinscribed itself among communities that think of themselves as quite sort of liberal and progressive.
And so let's talk a bit about COVID, because, you know, COVID, like climate change, affects people of color, Black, Latino, Black, Indigenous, and people of color disproportionately in this country and around the world. So you draw a lot of those connections. Your experience, we are all experiencing those connections. And so talk first about immunity, the development of the immune system, and why are communities of color being disproportionately affected?
So, I mean, there's many reasons, but one of the things that really struck me in the book was how our immunity and our immune response, our inflammatory response, and COVID is invoking a inflammatory response in the body, is tuned by the sum of our exposures, not just in our lives, but even in our ancestors' lives. So communities that have experienced a lot of intergenerational trauma, suffered from the impacts of genocide or the ongoing impacts of genocide as Indigenous people in the United States, these kinds of effects, communities that are subjected to air pollution, like folks are here in East Oakland with the ABNI foundry and the diesel burning from the port. So these kinds of additive exposures tune the immune system. And if there's a toxic, damaging set of exposures, you're going to have a much more intense inflammatory response. One of the things I was really interested in was learning that a marker of having severe COVID was having low levels of circulating interferons, which is a molecule that interferes with viral replication in the body. So it's a protective molecule. And groups that have encountered chronic social defeat have lower levels. People who have experienced chronic social defeat have lower levels of circulating interferons. So while genetics does play a role, what we're seeing is that the environment, which is really dictated by the social structures around us, is playing a much more important role. And COVID has, we weren't expecting, as we thought of this book 3 years ago, we weren't expecting to be here. But it was almost traumatizing to be writing this book while I was a frontline doctor in the hospital. So go between sitting at the desk for 10 hours a day to going into the hospital and watching this all play out in the wards of who was getting sick and how they were getting sick. And it's been quite a year.
Raj, I wanted to ask you, both of you, Raj Patel and Rupa Marya, talk about the impact of growing up as part of a diaspora of colonization. And of course, most of us, unless we're indigenous members of an indigenous group, are part of a colonized diaspora. And I was really interested about how you ask questions about collective identity and decolonization, and kind of pose the idea, how do we both unify, you know, conquer the divisions that the ruling class, which for want of a better word, I'm just going to call them that, used to divide us, without, you know, how do we unify, not fall prey to division, and yet also respect each and every one of us and our traditions?
Well, you know, I mean, nations are imagined communities, and the ways that capitalist colonialist nations imagine themselves are precisely sort of as having a manifest destiny to be here in what is now the United States. But I think it's very interesting to then have a conversation about what sorts of imagination of community are going to be consonant with the future of the planet. Part of the imagination of that and part of the exercise of decolonization seems utterly impossible because our standard narratives of nationhood just don't admit that we are settlers here. And so it's very hard to get that conversation off the ground without the spiraling into some sort of individual therapy or self-flagellation. What's interesting then is to look at the history of medicine to see how decolonization has happened before. And you know, we look in this book, in Inflamed, we look at some, you know, one of the leading theorists of decolonization who was also a medic, Frantz Fanon. And as a psychiatrist, he was trying very hard to decolonize medicine in Algeria when he was treating middle-class settler French women in Algeria. He, you know, rather than sort of locking them up, you know, sort of reconfigured the architecture of the psychiatric ward so that women would be able to have access to a printing press and a film club. And this was a way in which they would be able to manage, you know, the circulation of representation, of media, of, you know, of ways that they could tell stories about themselves. And, you know, that was very successful as far as it went. And for Algerian working class men, you know, cinema and newsletters weren't what they wanted. They wanted to play football. And so it was going outside the boundaries of the daily reminders of their colonial confinement that the men that Fanon worked with found a certain kind of liberation and a certain kind of healing. But Fanon, in the end, left his practice because, among other things, he noted, doctors still own the land. And that story of, you know, of how ultimately we do need to take a relationship to the ground beneath our feet is tremendously important in the practice of decolonizing. So while I come from, you know, my parents are were Fijian and Kenyan, and before that, you know, from sort of greater South Asia. But the stories that matter now are not really ones that my parents freighted from India to, you know, parts of the British Empire that I now bring to this settled land in occupied Texas. But they're the stories of the many nations that were once on the land that I find myself on right now, of, you know, Comanche and Isleta del Sur Pueblo and Lipan Apache. And so there's a range of stories, but none of them have the same kinds of will to power over the rest of the web of life that capitalist colonialism does. And I think part of the work that we're doing, you know, this is not just a writerly work, but the work of organizing around social change is to co-create these new decolonial narratives and nationhoods that emerge from the ashes of colonial capitalism.
Yes, and I'm so impressed. Rupa Marya, talking, I was reading about all the different projects, organizing projects you've been involved in. Tell us about Deep Medicine, your Deep Medicine Circle, and about the clinic and the farm that you've established on Lakota territory at the invitation of the folks there.
Yeah. Well, this last year, we formed an organization, a nonprofit organization, a group of farmers, healers, indigenous, non-indigenous people together to heal the wounds of colonialism through food, medicine, story, learning, and restoration. And so that work is housed within what we're calling the Deep Medicine Circle. We're a woman of color-led organization, and we work as a worker-directed nonprofit. And we are right now, one of our main projects is what we're calling Farming as Medicine, where we're reframing farmers as ecological stewards to care for the soil and the water and liberating the food that's grown from the market economy to be given to people who are being oppressed by hunger in the urban environments. So one of those farms is a 38-acre farm that we're in the process of working with the Association of Ramatish Ohlone on rematriating the land back to them. And that is just an amazing and beautiful project. And another is an acre of rooftop farm in Oakland, where that food is going to be going to UCSF's pediatric clinic right next door, so that none of the kids who come to the clinic will leave without access to organic, healthy food. And then also with Poor Magazine in Deep East Oakland, who have a radical redistribution network in Oakland for poor and unhoused people. And so these are exciting projects because we're bringing together, you know, people in healthcare with people in farming and food and community activists who are really trying to take their health into, they are taking their health into their own hands and defining what that is and what is needed for that. And it's an exciting time also to reframe food as, you know, and farming as a solution to what we're seeing with climate, you know, the climate collapse, and paying our farmers excellent wages as frontline health workers, because that's what they are.
And finally, you know, what seems to me so much at the core of this book is, you know, the totally different way that human beings have lived for hundreds of thousands of years on this planet, and the way that we live under capitalism. You know, I was reading a book recently. It was a science fiction book called Ministry of the Future. I always blank on the author's name, but he says it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And that really struck me, because we are so bound by this enchantment, I think, of the capitalist system. What gives you hope? What gives you strength in doing the work that both of you are doing to bring the world back to its senses?
Well, you know, I mean, I love The Ministry of the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. And, you know, I think one of the things that's missing from that book is the kinds of things that give us hope, I think. I'll certainly speak for myself about, but I know Rupert feels the same way about the social movements around the world that are in the front lines of the struggle and are fighting despite all the odds. You know, if one were to do a pessimistic accounting, things are looking fairly bleak. And yet, despite this pessimism of the intellect, there is an optimism of the will that's both necessary and required in order not to betray the movements that are already fighting in the front lines. And so what gives me hope is the fact that there are folk who are doing this and winning, despite the fact that capitalism is doing its damnedest to send us all spiraling to our doom. So, you know, what gives me hope is that people are still fighting back.
And Rupa?
For me, what gives me hope is the arts and the music that's coming out of these movements, and seeing the power of people imagining a better future, and how potent and powerful that imagination is. Because in the imagining, we see the way, we see the way forward. And that always gives me hope, even as I'm, you know, currently taping down the windows of my house so that the wildfire smoke doesn't get in. I still feel hopeful when I see that art and hear that music and see those stories.
Well, I'm going to take that hope to heart right now. And your book is such an amazing, it's a map. It's a map in that territory toward that deep medicine that both of you speak so eloquently about. The book is Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. And thank you so much, Raj Patel and Rupa Marya, for speaking with us here about it on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. And stay safe if that hurricane comes your way.
Yeah, I'll do my best.
Thank you so much.
Rupa Marya and Raj Patel. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Inflamed. You can also hear my interviews with Raj Patel about his best-selling book, The Value of Nothing, and the one I did with him about another book of his, Stuffed and Starved. Next up, a children's book from country music star Jimmy Allen. Stay tuned after the break.
I'm ready to be the version of me that 8-year-old Jimmy knew I could be.
I'm just flesh and bone, heart and soul, and I've earned a couple scars. I've let once in a lifetime kind of things slide right out of my arms. I struck out, I've been knocked down more times than I can count. But that don't matter now, 'cause when you smile, I see the sun sink down on a coast out in California. And there's no doubt, because of you, I'm not the man I was before you. I'm not saying that I'm perfect, oh, 'cause girl, you know I'm not. But I love you with everything I got. Girl, I'll give you my best shots. You saw a spark inside of me that no one else could find.
That was Jimmy Allen singing his hit song, Best Shot. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Singer Jimmy Allen is a rising star in the country music field. He's also one of the few black musicians to attain such fame in a genre largely dominated by white musicians. Clearly, he's used to using his voice to good effect. Now he's come out with a charming book for kids with an important message about using one's voice to make change, good change, in the world. It came about after the George Floyd protests last summer, when he was asked to write a book about using one's voice for change. His book is My Voice is a Trumpet. It's a lyrical celebration of the many types of voices that can affect change, from voices tall as a tree to voices small as a bee. All it takes is confidence and a belief in the goodness of others to change the world. The book for younger children is beautifully illustrated by Kathy Ann Johnson. Jimmy Allen, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
This book, first of all, it is a lovely book and beautifully illustrated. You were actually asked to write this book by the publisher after an interview that you gave in the wake of the protests against police brutality last summer. Tell us a little bit about that interview that you gave. You know, what was your point of view, and why do you think that inspired somebody to reach out to you about writing this, your first book?
You know, it was because I remember in the interview, we were just talking about, you know, people using their voices, you know, because I feel like a lot of times we see things happen that shouldn't, you know, whether it's in school, whether it's on the street, you know, whether it has to do with, you know, whatever it has to do with, you know, it's not really limited to what you call, I guess, police officers or politicians or anything like that. It's everything. You know, if you're at work and you're a nurse, you know, and I have nurse friends seen it, and you see a doctor being lazy, taking a shortcut, that can cost somebody their life. You speak up. You know what I mean? The same thing with the George Floyd thing. It was like, man, I got all this happening, right? And what annoyed me a lot was definitely the police officer, but also all the people just standing around on the side just videotaping. That does nothing to save George's life. You know what I mean? It's just a videotape. So, you know what I mean? You're not interfering with anything. You're just watching him die, you know? So that's my biggest thing, is having courage. You know what I mean? And that's really what the book is about. The book is to have courage, not to just stand around and watch, but to do something. You know what I mean? And if we could start teaching children that at a young age, that, hey, you're special, you're important. Also have the courage to believe in yourself and the courage to stand up when things aren't going well. You know what I mean? So that was kind of the whole purpose of that conversation. And my publishers reached out. So shout out to Margaret over at Flamingo and Penguin. I just wanted to write the book. I felt like it was a message that we could kind of simplify for children to kind of start them off on that path of self-confidence at a young age.
Yes. And, you know, I went online and I saw that, I saw your video, music video of Best Shot. And you have, I assume that's your father, a picture of your father carrying you when you were a little kid. Is that right?
In the beginning, and it looks like a home movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's me and my dad. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a very loving picture. How did you learn to use your voice as a kid? Is that something your dad encouraged?
My parents? Yeah, my mom and my dad. You know, they're old school, and that's probably where I come from. You know, they come from the class of no excuses, get it done. The only person's opinion that matters should be your own. You know, your confidence shouldn't waver because of someone else's thoughts on you. That's why it's called self-esteem, not other people's esteem. You know what I mean? No matter what someone says about me or thinks about me, never lowers my confidence in myself. It never has and it never will. And that's because of what my parents taught me and how they raised me. And I'm like, man, if we could get that type of confidence, you know, into my children and then the other kids, you wouldn't have so many people. Most people are sheep, call them sheeple. You know, they just do stuff because that's what the majority does. And they don't want to be the one that's doing something different. Not because they actually believe in what they're doing it. They're just doing it. That's how I honestly feel about golf. I don't really think many people like golf that they say they do. Golf is just cool to like right now. So everybody's liking golf. But I guarantee 80% out there playing golf, people playing golf probably out there like, what the heck am I doing out here right now? Like,
yeah, well, I have to agree with you. I was saying something very similar to that to my granddaughter last week. You know, why do people play golf?
It'd be like, but I say that to say, it's about not following the majority. It's about following what you want. And I feel like if we had more people just doing what they wanted and what they believed in and never sacrificed, you know, who they were for someone else, I feel like the world would be in a better place. You know, how many times, you know, do you have one, if say you got one kid in school making fun of a kid, right? And then other kids chime in because they see someone else doing it. So they start doing it. So next thing you know, you got 10 kids picking on this kid, right? And 9 of them really don't want to. So now it's 10 against 1. But if the tables were flipped and those 9 stood up for that one kid, it'd have been 10 people standing up for him versus the one kid that's trying to bully him. See what I'm saying? So it's all about, you know, trying to give them confidence.
Yeah, and you know what you're saying, I think, has a very big lesson right now in America, because it seems that bullying is really on the rise. You've got people who are anti-mask, anti-vaccine, who are bullying school boards. You have a whole, you know, a whole lot of people, you know, in various legislatures who are trying to make illegal talking about racism in American history in the schools. So this is a very important time, as there's a kind of rise of anti-democratic forces, for a book with your message.
You know, my view on it is this, you know, racism, slavery, it's American history. So if we're going to talk about American history, let's talk about American history. You know what I mean? A lot of people don't want to do that because it makes them feel uncomfortable and it goes against their narrative. But for me, you know, when it comes to other stuff, whether it's masks, whether it's vaccines, whether it's your sports teams, whatever, that's one of those situations where I tell people, you do what makes you feel comfortable. You know what I mean? You do this, and this is why I feel like the world would be a better place. If everybody would just mind their business, we good. Half of the problem we have is people sitting home, right, looking at what somebody else is doing at their house, trying to tell them how to live their life. That's my biggest issue. If everybody would just worry about themselves, that's what my grandfather said. I asked my grandpa about everything. So he don't go to strip club. Strip clubs are open. I was like, well, why not? He said, I'm not into it. But whoever else wants to go to strip club, go. He had that same thing when they started opening restaurants for COVID. He's like, look, I understand. People got to make money. He said, I don't really feel comfortable going. I'm not going, but I'm not going to stop nobody else from going. See what I'm saying? Because he said, me worried about what they're doing out there isn't bothering me if I'm sitting at home. So that's my thing with everything. It's like, man, if we would just focus on being a good person, minding our own business, and if we do want to think about what other people are doing, let's try to put ourselves in their situation and see where they're coming from before we're quick to judge what they're doing. And that's what I do in life over any subject, because I never know what somebody's going through. You know, and that was one of the main conversations with the George Floyd thing and with like racism and stuff like that. It's like, man, it's going to take a while to change, because it's like, say you're someone that was raised by a racist family in Georgia, down in the South, they're third generation, right? So their whole life, they are taught that they are superior to Black people because of the color of their skin. So when the rest of the world wakes them up to the fact that no, we're equal, the only difference is the white folk, y'all decided to move away from the equator sooner. So your skin got lighter. You know what I mean? You didn't need the melanin to protect you from the sunshine. That's it. They literally, people hate people because they live closer to the sun. So when the rest of the world awakes that racist person, it's going to take a while to unlearn everything they've been taught. Like, say you wake up today and you find out that the color blue is actually red. In your head, you're going to be like, this is crazy. I don't believe it. No, it's blue. It's blue. But the rest of the world is telling you, no, that's not blue. It's red. So you got to find a way to go back and unprocess and unlearn everything that's been jammed into your brain since you were a kid.
Well, let me ask you, because you are a Black country music singer, a genre that is dominated by white musicians. In fact, your hit song Best Shot made you the first Black artist to send a debut single to the top of the Billboard Country Airplay chart. And Make Me Want To also was on there. When so much about race in America is turned into a culture war, often by the guys who are trying to keep white supremacy alive. Do you feel like that kind of culture war is breaking down in the country music field? Do you feel like you and other Black country music singers are helping to change the frame?
Yeah, and we're changing the frame, but we're also changing the frame with the help of our white counterparts. You know what I mean? Because the world, when people understand what I like to see is, all these old racist people, they're dying. They're dying quick. You know what I'm saying? And we're in the industry now, and it's getting to the point where a lot of the white people in country music now, especially country music fans, are progressive. They listen to everything. They listen to country. They listen to hip-hop. So for them, it ain't no big deal if you Black, white, Spanish, whatever. You like the song? You got a good song? They're into it. So that's what's helping. What's helping is Black artists like me, Kane Brown, Mickey Guyton, et cetera, not being afraid to come into the format knowing we got to deal with still, you know, some of these racist hillbillies or whatever. But in time, we have a lot of our white counterparts supporting us. You know what I mean? Backing us up. And what happens is it's slowly pushing, you know, them out of the racist people out of the way. So you can slowly start to see the bad energy removed out of what used to be this white dominated format. Now I feel like it's getting to the point where it's just about music. That's it. You know, if you're a country artist, great. If you like country music, great. Every other genre of music, you never hear, man, that's the first song ever done by a Hispanic or a white or a black this, black. No, it's just about the music. In pop music, you don't even hear the color of the skin. People don't even say that. Like, oh, who sings this song? Oh, it's so-and-so. Oh, great. What's her Instagram? Or what's his Instagram? Boom, follow, boom. You don't never hear them say, oh, you know, it's this new black pop artist. No, you don't hear that. You know what I mean? And I feel like we're finally starting to get to that point in country music. But you know what it takes? It takes people using their voice. It takes people not being afraid of the backlash they might get from cowards who don't feel the same. You know what I mean? And everything, life is, the older I get, I realize life is about the simple message of my voice is a trumpet, meaning a constant reminder to yourself that your opinion matters to you, that you matter, that what you say matters, what you say can change an entire wave of someone's life. And I feel like I'm realizing that now as an adult. How do I give kids that message when they're young so that way they're not my age realizing that, they're realizing that in first or second grade?
And the book is My Voice is a Trumpet. It is a beautiful picture book, beautiful illustrations. And I love the text. Jimmy Allen, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you. It's been a joy.
And the book is My Voice is a Trumpet. And speaking of new books for young children, another one that crossed my desk recently is Monster in the Water. And no, it's not for Halloween, and it's not about the Loch Ness Monster. It's about a monster that's in a lot of the water bodies around me these days, harmful algal blooms. It's a huge problem on the east end of Long Island where I live. Sickens pets, closes beaches, and shuts down shellfish harvesting. Monster in the Water is written by 16-year-old Dylan Daggate, who also lives on Long Island, and like most of us here, has always felt deeply connected to the water. On his website, beatthebloom.com, that's for algal bloom, he writes, "While water is used for many different purposes in our everyday lives, it shouldn't be taken for granted. Because water is one of Earth's most precious natural resources, it should be protected and respected." He goes on to write, "Harmful algal blooms have become a growing environmental problem, causing devastation in my community and communities around the world. I wrote Monster in the Water, Fighting Back Against Harmful Algal Blooms, to raise awareness about this important issue and encourage young people to take action." The story is about the children of Seaville, who get a nasty surprise when they go to the beach and find it closed. They enlist the help of an environmental scientist to tell them what's going on and why, and they also find out about how they and their families can help to stop harmful algal blooms. Written by a kid for kids, this is a great book to share with the kids in your life. And next week on Writer's Voice, two novels about World War II from a very different perspective than the usual ones. We talk with Jai Chakrabarty about his novel, A Play for the End of the World. And then novelist Carolyn Lee tells us about her book, The Metal Heart. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.